So, I want you to imagine an 86-year-old man, and let's call him the perfect patient.
Okay.
He goes into the hospital for a pretty serious cardiac issue, and the system just works flawlessly.
Right, the dream scenario.
Exactly. The surgeons are brilliant. The procedure is a total success. The textbook protocols are followed to the absolute letter.
Which is what you want.
Yeah, of course. And a week later, his charts look incredible. His blood pressure is totally normalized. His heart rhythm is stable. So the medical team signs his discharge papers, they shake his hand, and they send him home. And, they mark him down in the system as a definitive medical victory. He's cured.
It sounds like, the ideal outcome, the system functioning exactly as it was designed to.
On paper, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
But then 3 weeks later, that exact same man is dead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And not because his heart failed organically, but because the new medication schedule they gave him, it was printed in a font that was just too small for his failing eyesight. Right, he couldn't read the labels, so he mixed up his blood thinners, and the quote-unquote cure effectively killed him. So it leaves you asking, did modern medicine save this man, or did it fail him entirely?
And that, I mean, that is the terrifying paradox of modern healthcare right there. We have constructed this system that is, it's just incredibly adept at fixing a biological machine, but it's often completely blind to the reality of the actual living organism operating that machine.
Exactly. And that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a genuinely revolutionary medical manuscript today.
It really is.
It's titled Internal Medicine Made Easy: A Life Coherent Guide to Clinical Reasoning, Physiology, and Healing by Dr. Bechara Sidi-Kelly. And for you listening, whether you were trying to advocate for a parent in the hospital, or you're navigating your own chronic illness, or honestly, if you're just fascinated by how expert minds solve really high-stakes puzzles, this is basically your decoder ring.
Yeah, it's a completely different way of looking at things.
The core argument here is that treating a disease label is dangerously incomplete. Medicine has to treat the living person through what the author calls a life-coherent clinical loop.
Which is just a massive paradigm shift. I mean, it moves the clinician's gaze away from the isolated pathology, the broken valve or the clogged artery, and it forces them to look at the entire human ecosystem.
Because we tend to think of going to the doctor like taking a car to the mechanic. I know I definitely do.
Oh, totally. It's the standard analogy.
Right. You hear a rattle, you take it in, the mechanic runs a diagnostic, finds the busted spark plug, swaps it out, and you drive away. It's transactional. It's super localized.
Yeah, but this manuscript argues humans are absolutely nothing like cars.
Not at all.
We aren't just a collection of independent parts that can be swapped out. We are these highly interconnected, really fragile ecosystems. Fixing the quote-unquote engine is entirely pointless if the driver is blind and the road is washed out.
Yeah, that mechanic analogy, it's pervasive because it's comforting.
Right. Exactly. We want to believe that if something hurts, there is a single, identifiable, localizable cause. Just find it, cut it out, fix it. But the author identifies a core problem that's actually rooted at the very foundation of how doctors are trained. He calls it the illusion of the textbook.
Okay, walk me through that, because
Yeah,
I
I
think
will.
most of us assume medical training is, the most rigorous education on the planet.
Well, it is rigorous, absolutely. But historically, it's highly compartmentalized. Like, medical students spend years learning from textbooks that are divided into these incredibly neat, fragmented chapters.
Right.
You study cardiology for a few weeks, and then you just close that book and open neurology. And then you move on to nephrology, the kidneys. And in these chapters, diseases essentially exist in a vacuum.
They're totally isolated.
Yes. A patient with pneumonia is described as having a fever, a productive cough, and, a classic cloudy spot on a chest x-ray. The textbook presents this as a pristine, isolated event.
And the test questions reflect that too, I imagine. Patient presents with X, Y, and Z. What is the diagnosis?
Right. You pick pneumonia from the multiple choice list, you get an A, and boom, you become a doctor.
But the reality at the hospital bedside is, I mean, it's chaotic. Patients don't walk through the ER doors as neatly formatted textbook paragraphs.
They really don't. They arrive whole, and they arrive unbelievably messy.
Yeah.
The patient with the cloudy lung x-ray doesn't just have pneumonia. They also have an underlying heart condition. Or maybe they have chronic kidney disease from 30 years of poorly managed
Or
diabetes.
they're clinically depressed.
Exactly. And maybe their primary caregiver at home is a spouse who is dealing with their own debilitating arthritis.
So the medical textbook fragments the patient into these organ systems, but the patient demands to be treated as a unified whole.
And this leads to a crucial concept in the manuscript, which is the same label, different reality phenomenon. We rely so heavily on these diagnostic labels, assuming they describe some universal truth, but they don't.
Let's ground this for a second, because if you and I both get diagnosed with pneumonia, isn't the biological mechanism exactly the same? Like a bacteria or a virus has infected our lung tissue, it's causing inflammation, the label is accurate, right?
The label might be biologically accurate in isolation, yeah. But clinically, it might be functionally useless.
Interesting.
The manuscript asks us to envision two separate patients. Both have pneumonia written in bold letters on their intake charts. Now, patient A has a mild fever and a nagging cough. However, they are fully hydrated, mentally sharp, and they can easily walk themselves to the bathroom and back.
So they basically get some antibiotics and go home to rest.
Most likely, yeah. Now look at patient B. They also have pneumonia, but their immune system has completely overreacted and it sent them into a state of sepsis.
Okay.
Their blood vessels are dilating rapidly, which causes their blood pressure to just plummet. And because their blood pressure is crashing, their brain isn't getting enough oxygen. So they are delirious, hallucinating, they're terrified.
Oh, well.
And because the blood pressure is low, the kidneys are starving and failing. So you have an acute kidney injury. They physically cannot support their own body weight to even stand up.
So it's the exact same disease label.
Okay.
But patient A needs a prescription and a ride home, while patient B is actively dying and needs intensive care.
Right. The clinical reality, the immediate danger, the required resources, the trajectory of care, it's entirely different. If a clinician just treats the label, they fail the patient.
I hear this, but let me play devil's advocate for just a moment here.
Sure.
We live in an era of hyper-specialization for a reason. If I have a tumor in my brain, I don't want a generalist who looks at my whole ecosystem.
Yay.
I want the neurosurgeon who has done absolutely nothing but look at that specific lobe of the brain for 20 years.
Of course.
Doesn't specialization inherently require fragmentation?
Yeah.
Like, we want the kidney expert focusing obsessively on the kidney.
We undeniably need that deep, laser-focused expertise. I mean, hyperspecialization has given us treatments and surgeries that would look like actual magic to a doctor 50 years ago.
Right.
But the author's point is that while the knowledge can be specialized, the patient cannot be fragmented. Organs simply do not operate in isolated silos. They are engaged in this constant, dynamic negotiation with each other.
So what happens when the specialist forgets to look at the negotiation and only looks at their specific organ?
Well, the manuscript provides a chillingly common example of exactly that. Imagine a patient under the care of a brilliant cardiologist. The patient has congestive heart failure, which means the heart pump is weak and fluid is backing up into the lungs,
making it incredibly difficult to breathe.
Exactly. So the cardiologist's goal is crystal clear. Clear the fluid, save the lungs. So they prescribe a very potent diuretic.
A water pill. It forces the body to, pee out the excess fluid.
Yes. And from a purely cardiac and pulmonary perspective, it's the perfect move. The diuretic does its job. The fluid leaves the lungs. The patient can breathe deeply again. The heart specialist has achieved a textbook victory.
I sense a massive but coming here.
But the body is a closed loop. Where did that fluid actually come from? The diuretic forced the kidneys to aggressively pull sodium and water out of the blood. This rapidly decreases the overall volume of blood circulating in the patient's body.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, the kidneys require a very specific high-pressure flow of blood to function. If the blood volume drops too quickly because of that diuretic, the pressure drops. The delicate filtration units inside the kidneys, the glomeruli, suddenly find themselves starving for oxygen.
Because there literally isn't enough blood pressure to push the oxygen-rich blood into those tiny kidney vessels.
Exactly. So the lung problem is solved, yes. But because the system wasn't viewed as a whole, the patient is now in acute renal failure. The cure for the lungs completely destroyed the kidneys.
That is deeply unsettling. Because it implies that rushing straight to a fix for a specific organ can actually be the most dangerous thing a doctor can do.
And that is precisely why the manuscript demands that we completely abandon the instinct to jump straight to a diagnosis. Before anyone tries to name the disease or fix the broken part, the clinician must establish an absolute safety floor. You just cannot begin to solve a puzzle if the table it's sitting on is currently on fire.
Which brings us to the very first phase of this life coherent framework. The author calls it danger first thinking.
Yes.
Now, when I hear the word danger, I think of panic. I think of alarms blaring, people running down the hospital halls, total chaos.
It's actually the exact opposite of panic. Danger first thinking is a deeply structured, hyper-calm cognitive discipline. It's all about ordered safety. It forces the clinician to pause and ask one very simple, incredibly profound question. What must not be missed right now?
Meaning, before we get out our magnifying glasses and like play detective to figure out the exact nuance of your illness, what is happening in this room right now that could kill you, disable you, or cause irreversible harm in the next 5 minutes?
That's exactly the mindset. You have to secure the foundation before you inspect the wallpaper.
It's like walking into a house that is actively on fire. The detective instinct is to start digging through the ashes in the living room to figure out if it was a faulty electrical socket or maybe a knocked over candle that started the blaze.
Yeah.
But danger first thinking says, who cares what started it? Is the roof about to collapse on my head? Is there someone trapped on the second floor? The diagnosis of the fire's origin can wait until tomorrow. The collapsing roof literally cannot.
That is a phenomenal analogy. To prevent clinicians from getting distracted by the origin of the fire, the text outlines a very rigid mental structure used in emergency medicine called the ADCDE screen.
Okay.
It's basically a checklist for the collapsing roof. A stands for airway. Is the tube from the mouth to the lungs open, or is it swelling shut from an allergic reaction?
Right. Gotta breathe.
Exactly. B is breathing. Is the brain actually sending the signal to inflate the lungs, and are the lungs physically expanding? C is circulation. Is the heart actually pumping blood, and is there enough blood pressure to reach the brain? D is disability, which primarily looks at brain regulation and consciousness. And E is exposure.
Exposure meaning what? Like literally exposing the skin?
Literally taking off the blankets and the clothes to look at the entire physical landscape of the patient.
Oh, wow.
Are there hidden signs of trauma? Maybe a spreading rash indicative of meningitis, a hidden bleeding wound. You cannot assess danger if the danger is hiding under a hospital gown.
That makes total sense.
But what is truly notable in Dr. Sahili's framework is that he explicitly elevates another vital sign to this immediate life or death checklist, glucose.
Blood sugar. Okay. I mean, I understand why checking if someone has an open airway is a first 5 seconds priority. But why is blood sugar elevated to that same critical level?
Because the brain is a highly demanding, incredibly vulnerable organ. Unlike your muscles, which can store their own backup energy reserves, the brain cannot store glucose.
It just doesn't have the capacity.
Right. It relies on a continuous, uninterrupted delivery of sugar from the bloodstream. If blood sugar drops dangerously low, a state called hypoglycemia, the brain cells immediately begin to misfire and starve.
And what does that look like from the outside, like to the doctor?
It looks terrifying. It can perfectly mimic a massive stroke. The patient might lose the ability to speak. Half of their face might droop. They might collapse into a full grand mal seizure, or they might just become violently confused and agitated.
So a doctor might look at that and think, oh, we have a stroke, page neurology, prep the MRI scanner.
Exactly. And the manuscript stresses that if you send that patient for a full hour-long neurological workup and MRI, without first pricking their finger to check their glucose, you are committing a catastrophic error.
Because you missed the easy fix.
Because the fix for hypoglycemia is immediate. You push an ampule of basically sugar water into their 5E, and they wake up and start talking normally in literally 60 seconds.
That's wild.
But if you wait, if you chase the complex diagnosis instead of checking the simple danger, the brain starvation becomes permanent. You miss the reversible danger.
It requires a massive amount of discipline to not jump to the complex, interesting conclusion, right? And instead, stay rooted in the boring foundational safety checks.
Yes.
And the text warns about a specific psychological trap that derails this discipline. It's called the just trap.
Ah, the dismissal trap. This is where medical bias directly intersects with patient harm. The author provides these brilliant, terrifying work cases to illustrate how our brains use the word just to avoid doing the hard work of danger first thinking.
Let's look at the just anxiety trap.
Okay.
A 31-year-old woman walks into the emergency room. She is clutching her chest. She says her chest feels tight. She can't catch her breath. And she is experiencing this overwhelming sense of impending doom. And she tells the triage nurse, I have a history of panic attacks. This is just my anxiety acting up again.
The psychological pull for the clinician to just nod and agree is immense in that situation.
Oh, I'm sure.
The ER is crowded. There are a dozen other patients waiting, and the patient has practically handed you the diagnosis on a silver platter.
Right. It takes 5 seconds to say, I see your history. Here's a paper bag to breathe into. Try to calm down. We'll get you a mild sedative.
But the Danger First clinician recognizes that anxiety does not make you immune to biological emergencies. The text forces the clinician to ask, what else presents with a racing heart, chest tightness, and a profound sense of doom? A pulmonary embolism.
A blood clot in the lung.
Yes, a clot breaks off, travels through the heart, and wedges itself tightly into the pulmonary artery. Suddenly, a massive section of the lung is no longer exchanging oxygen.
Oh, man.
The oxygen levels in the blood begin to drop. The brain senses this hypoxia, this starvation of oxygen, and it triggers a massive adrenaline dump to try and save itself. The heart races to compensate. The patient feels a primal biological terror.
It looks identical to a psychological panic attack.
Identical.
But if you hand a patient with a pulmonary embolism a paper bag to breathe into, they will suffocate and die in that waiting room chair.
The final diagnosis, after you run the tests, might very well be a panic attack. The patient might be totally fine, but the framework dictates that danger must be actively excluded before reassurance can be safely given. Premature reassurance is a lethal trap.
There's another case study that really stuck with me, the just dementia trap.
Yeah, this is tragically common in elder care. An 86-year-old man who has a known documented history of Alzheimer's disease is suddenly vastly more confused overnight. He is agitated, he's pulling at his clothes, maybe he's trying to climb over the bed rails.
And the knee-jerk reaction from the staff or even the family is, well, his dementia is progressing. He's just confused because he has dementia.
And again, the word just blinds the observer. The manuscript makes a vital physiological distinction here. Dementia is a chronic, slowly progressive disease. It degrades the brain over years.
Right.
Known dementia does not explain an acute, dramatic change in behavior that happens over 12 hours. That sudden spike in confusion is almost certainly delirium, not dementia.
So what is delirium, mechanically speaking?
Delirium is a state of acute brain dysfunction, usually driven by a systemic stressor. And the Danger First clinician knows that the stressor is often totally reversible.
Like what?
It could be an undiagnosed urinary tract infection. In an elderly patient, a simple UTI causes massive systemic inflammation. Those inflammatory markers cross the blood-brain barrier, scramble the neurotransmitters, and the patient begins hallucinating.
Just from a UTI.
Just from UTI.
Right.
Or it could be acute urinary retention. His bladder is completely full and he cannot void, causing agonizing pain that he cannot verbally articulate because of the baseline dementia, so he just thrashes in bed.
And dismissing it as just dementia condemns the man to suffer from a highly painful, highly treatable infection.
It strips away the clinical curiosity required to find the actual danger.
But you know, the most surprising part of this whole danger section for me wasn't about missed blood clots or hidden infections. The text points out a hidden manger that doctors orchestrate themselves every single day, the unsafe discharge.
Yes. We tend to view discharging a patient from the hospital as a purely administrative victory. You know, the paperwork is signed, the bed is freed up, the bell is rung.
Right. The chart says the infection is gone, therefore you are healed. Go home.
But Dr. Saifeli argues that discharge is not an administrative event. It is a profound clinical intervention. It is the active transfer of extreme risk from a highly monitored, resource-rich environment, the hospital, to an unmonitored, complex environment, the home.
The hospital is essentially functioning as an exoskeleton for the patient.
I love that phrase. Yes.
It's providing IV fluids, nurses checking blood pressure every 4 hours, someone physically walking them to the bathroom so they don't fall.
So if the disease is quote-unquote cured, the pneumonia is gone, the fever has broken, but the patient is still incredibly weak from lying in a bed for 2 weeks, sending them home is a danger. If they cannot safely navigate the stairs to their own bathroom, or if their mild cognitive impairment means they're going to mix up the five new medications you just prescribed, you haven't succeeded. You have actively engineered an unsafe environment.
So the fundamental question isn't, is the disease gone? The question is, can this human being safely execute this medical plan in their actual living room?
Exactly.
So if the doctor manages to avoid all these traps, they've run the ABCDE screen, they check the blood sugar, they ignore the temptation to say it's just anxiety, and they know the patient is not going to crash in the next hour. The safety floor is built.
Right.
What happens next?
Yeah.
We move from securing the building to actually trying to figure out what's wrong.
We transition from establishing safety to organizing the chaos. The author calls this moving from symptoms to syndromes.
Which starts with acknowledging that symptoms are, on their own, incredibly insufficient. Which is funny because as patients, symptoms are all we have. Like my head hurts, I feel dizzy, I have this shooting pain in my leg.
A symptom is a vital piece of data, yes. It is the patient's subjective, lived experience of their body. But clinically, a symptom is far too broad to act upon. If a patient says, I have chest pain, they have given you a symptom. But what does that actually mean?
It could mean 100 different things.
Exactly. Chest pain could be a myocardial infarction, a massive heart attack. It could be a tearing of the aorta, which is an immediate surgical emergency. It could be severe gastroesophageal reflux, where stomach acid is burning the esophagus.
Like really bad heartburn.
Yeah. It could be costochondritis, which is just inflammation of the cartilage connecting the ribs. Or, as we discussed, it could be a panic attack. If a clinician tries to treat a symptom, they are basically throwing darts blindfolded.
So they have to build a syndrome.
Yeah.
What is the architecture of a syndrome? How do you take that vague symptom and give it edges?
Building a syndrome is about finding the pattern that organizes the uncertainty. It's a formula. You take the primary symptom and you rigorously interrogate its parameters. First, the time course. Did this chest pain start suddenly like a thunderclap? Or has it been building gradually over 3 weeks?
A thunderclap implies something ruptured or blocked instantly. Gradual implies something growing or slowly failing.
Next, you add severity and character. Is it a sharp stabbing pain or a dull crushing pressure like an elephant sitting on your chest?
Right.
Then you look for associated features. Are they also sweating profusely? Are they nauseous? Is the pain radiating down their left arm or up into their jaw? Finally, you layer in the objective vital signs and the specific context of the patient, their age, their medical history, their habits.
So contrast the raw symptom with the fully built syndrome for me.
The symptom is simply chest pain. The syndrome is acute, sudden onset, central pressure type chest pain that radiates to the left arm, accompanied by severe nausea and cold sweats, occurring in a 62-year-old man with a 20-year history of poorly controlled diabetes.
Hearing that second description, even as a non-doctor, I can instantly see the shape of the emergency. It paints a vivid, terrifying picture.
Because the syndrome provides a roadmap. It moves the clinician out of the murky waters of vague complaints and into a highly focused pattern of illness. And once you have constructed that syndrome, you can begin to organize your differential diagnosis.
The differential diagnosis is just the list of possible diseases that could be causing the problem, right?
Yes. But the manuscript is fiercely strict about how this list is generated. You do not just vomit up a random encyclopedic list of every rare disease you memorized in your second year of medical school.
Which I assume doctors are tempted to do.
It leads to cognitive overload and unnecessary testing. You must organize the possibilities into four distinct buckets.
What are the buckets?
Likely, dangerous, treatable, and context-specific.
Okay, unpack those.
First, what is statistically the most likely disease causing this syndrome? Second, regardless of how likely it is, what is the most dangerous disease that fits this pattern? The one that will kill them by midnight if we miss it.
The danger first element again.
Exactly. Third, what is highly treatable right now? And fourth, what possibilities are unique to this specific patient's context? Like, did they just return from a tropical country? Are they undergoing chemotherapy? Do they have a history of intravenous drug use?
Okay, I have to stop you here. This is where I start wondering if human doctors are just going to be obsolete in 10 years.
Ah, the AI question.
Yeah. We live in the era of artificial intelligence and incredible diagnostic machinery. Why rely on a tired human brain to build a syndrome and sort through these buckets? Why not just draw 10 vials of blood, throw the patient into a full-body MRI, feed all the raw data into an algorithm, and let the computer spit out the absolute truth?
It is the most common critique of traditional clinical reasoning today. Why rely on the subjective when we have the objective? But the manuscript provides a profound defense of the clinician's mind. The argument is that medical investigations, the blood tests, the scans, the x-rays, must absolutely be guided by the syndrome, not ordered reflexively.
Why? If the scan shows everything, why not just scan everything?
Because testing is not just the passive accumulation of pure truth. Tests have blind spots. Tests have margins of error. A test is a tool designed to answer a highly specific clinical question generated by the syndrome. If you don't know what question you're asking, the answer the test gives you can be wildly misleading.
Give me an example of how a test can lie to you if you don't have the syndrome right.
Let's go back to our 62-year-old man with the crushing chest pain and the cold sweats. The syndrome is screaming high-risk cardiac event.
Right.
The patient arrives in the ER, and the very first thing they do is an ECG, an electrocardiogram, to measure the electrical activity of his heart. The readout comes back and the machine algorithm prints normal sinus rhythm. The ECG is totally clear.
The test says he's fine.
If you are relying solely on the machinery, you look at that clear ECG, you tell the patient he likely just has severe acid reflux, and you send him home.
And he dies in his driveway.
Because the clinician who trusts the syndrome knows how the biology actually works. An ECG measures dead or dying tissue. Early in a heart attack, the blood flow is blocked and the heart muscle is starving for oxygen, a state called ischemia. But the tissue hasn't fully died yet. It hasn't infarcted.
Okay.
During that early window, the electrical signals on the ECG can look entirely normal.
So the test is just too early to see the disaster.
Exactly. The text emphasizes that a reassuring initial assessment does not exclude an evolving disease if the syndrome points to danger. The machine doesn't know the patient is sweating profusely and has a 20-year history of diabetes.
The machine just sees a heartbeat.
Right. The syndrome overrides the test. The syndrome tells the doctor, do not trust that ECG. Keep him here, draw blood to look for cardiac enzymes, and repeat the ECG in 30 minutes. The human mind holds the context. The machine only holds the moment.
So the doctor holds the context, they repeat the tests, they trust the syndrome, and eventually they arrive at the working diagnosis. They name the beast. It is a myocardial infarction. But according to Dr. Sackley, diagnosing the disease is still only halfway there, because the label tells us the name of the biological error, but it tells us absolutely nothing about how that error is destroying the patient's actual life.
This is the philosophical core of the entire book. We transition from naming the pathology to mapping out the capacity failure. This demands a radical shift in vocabulary. The fundamental question is no longer, what disease is this? It becomes, what functions of human life can this patient no longer sustain?
The book lists these specific domains of life capacity, and reading them, it feels like learning a new language for illness.
It really does.
It completely bypasses words like lungs or kidneys. Instead, it talks about oxygenation, circulation, clearance, energy transformation, defense, regulation, mobility, cognition, comfort, agency, dignity, and participation.
It forces the clinician to translate microscopic cellular pathology into macro-level lived reality. Let's look at how the text applies this to heart failure.
Okay, so the label is heart failure, but what is the capacity failure?
If you just treat heart failure, you are treating a muscle. But if you look at capacity, you realize you are treating a cascade of systemic collapse. Because the heart pump is weak, it is a failure of circulation. Blood isn't moving efficiently.
Right.
Because blood isn't moving, fluid backs up into the venous system, pooling in the legs and abdomen.
So their ankles swell up to the size of balloons.
Yes. And because the blood pressure is inadequate, the kidneys cannot filter waste, leading to a failure of clearance. But it goes further into the human experience. Heart failure is profoundly a failure of sleep.
Why sleep?
Because of a condition called orthopnea. During the day, gravity pulls that excess fluid down into the patient's legs. But when they lie flat in bed at night, gravity redistributes that fluid across their entire body, and it begins to seep into the tiny air sacs of their lungs.
Oh my God.
They wake up gasping, literally drowning in their own fluid. They cannot sleep unless they are propped up on four pillows in a recliner.
It's terrifying.
And finally, it is a failure of mobility. The heart cannot pump enough oxygenated blood to the leg muscles to allow the patient to walk to their own mailbox without stopping to rest.
Reframing it this way totally changes the entire metric of success. Like, the goal of the treatment isn't just to make the heart stronger on an ultrasound. The goal is to restore their ability to lie flat in bed, to restore their ability to walk to the mailbox, to restore clearance.
And this framework is equally powerful for conditions that the medical system often brushes off as merely psychological or subjective, like severe depression or chronic pain.
The text is adamant that these are not just emotional states. They are profound biological and systemic capacity failures.
They are devastating failures. Chronic pain is obviously a failure of comfort, but the constant neurological bombardment of pain signals destroys the architecture of the brain's rest cycles, leading to a total failure of sleep and energy transformation.
You are constantly exhausted because your brain is fighting a war every second of the day.
Crucially, severe depression and chronic pain represent a massive failure of agency. The patient develops learned helplessness. They feel entirely out of control of their own physical vessel, and that leads to a failure of participation. They drop out of the workforce, they stop socializing, their world shrinks to the size of their bedroom.
You brought up agency, and I want to hover on agency and dignity for a minute, because this is where the manuscript really threw a punch.
Yeah, this part is intense.
It argues that agency and dignity are not just, you know, HR buzzwords or nice things to have if the doctor has an extra 5 minutes to be polite. It categorizes them as hard clinical capacities.
It is perhaps the most radical argument in the framework. Dignity and agency are biological imperatives. Humans are social, autonomous creatures. When we are stripped of our agency, our bodies actually enter a state of profound physiological stress. Cortisol levels spike. Immune function drops.
A medical system strips agency away almost by default.
If a patient is coerced into a surgical procedure by an intimidating surgeon, if a woman's pain is dismissed by a rushed ER doctor who talks over her, or if an elderly man is handed a complex discharge plan that he is too embarrassed to admit he doesn't understand, their agency has failed.
And the doctor might think they provided excellent care because they prescribed the right pill.
But if the patient's agency has failed, the medical care is fundamentally corrupted. A treatment plan that a patient does not understand or does not agree with is a plan that will not be executed. The biological intervention will fail because the psychological foundation was destroyed.
It totally changes how a doctor should speak to a patient. It's the difference between a doctor standing over your bed and saying, your creatinine levels are at 3.5, we need to adjust your meds, versus sitting down at eye level and saying, your kidneys are currently failing to clear waste from your blood, and that is why you feel so nauseous and confused. We need to work together to restore that clearance.
Exactly.
One is abstract data. The other is a shared mission to restore life function.
It bridges the gap between the cellular pathology and the human soul.
So we've mapped out the failing capacities. Yeah. We know exactly what the patient can no longer do. Now we have to figure out why they can't do it. Why do two people with the exact same capacity failures have completely different trajectories?
Mm-hmm.
Why does one person heal at home while the other bounces right back into the emergency room 3 days later?
Right.
To answer that, the clinician has to look outside the patient's body. They have to examine the environment.
We enter the realm of coupling conditions, and the primary goal of this phase is to absolutely eradicate the artificial divide between what is medical and what is social.
Explain structural coupling, because it sounds like an engineering term.
It borrows from systems theory. The concept is that living organisms do not exist in a vacuum. They are structurally coupled to their environment. A tree is coupled to the soil, the rainfall, and the sunlight. A human patient is structurally coupled to their physical house, their bank account, their daily habits, their family dynamics, and their neighborhood.
And the manuscript argues that this social information is actually hard clinical data.
The author is uncompromising on this point. A patient's housing status or income level dictates their biological outcome just as strictly as their heart rate or their liver function.
The text uses a brilliant example regarding insulin. Let's walk through that because it perfectly illustrates how a perfect medical plan can violently collide with the real world.
Imagine an endocrinologist writes a highly sophisticated insulin prescription for a patient with advanced diabetes. It requires the patient to inject different amounts of insulin at very specific times of the day, carefully calibrated to their meals.
Okay.
Biologically, at a cellular level, this prescription is 100% flawless.
It's exactly what the pancreas needs.
But the clinician failed to assess the coupling conditions. Let's look at the patient's actual life. They have diabetic retinopathy, meaning their vision is severely degraded. They literally cannot see the tiny black lines on the insulin syringe to measure the correct dose.
Mm.
Furthermore, they live in a precarious housing situation and don't have a reliable refrigerator to store the insulin, so the medication begins to degrade in the heat.
And what about the timing of the meals?
The patient works unpredictable, variable shifts at a warehouse. Some days they eat lunch at noon, some days they don't eat until 4 p.m.
So if you inject insulin but don't eat food,
the insulin aggressively pulls all the existing glucose out of your blood. Your blood sugar crashes, you pass out on the warehouse floor, and you wake up in the back of an ambulance.
Now, the tragic part is, when that patient wakes up in the ER, the medical system will likely label them as non-compliant.
Exactly. The doctor looks at the chart and says, I gave you the perfect plan, and you didn't follow it. This is your fault.
Yeah.
But the biological deficiency wasn't the issue. The issue was a catastrophic treatment life mismatch. The environment simply could not support the biological treatment.
There was another example about heart failure that really drove this home. The revolving door patient.
The patient who is admitted to the hospital for fluid overload in their lungs for the third time in 6 months.
Right.
The fragmented, narrow approach is to sigh, give them an IV push of diuretics, clear the lungs, and send them home with the exact same prescription they had before.
expecting a different result.
But a life-coherent clinician, using the coupling approach, stops and investigates the environment. Why is the fluid building up? They ask the patient about their daily life. It turns out the patient has terrible arthritis in their knees. To manage the knee pain, they are taking high doses of over-the-counter NSAIDs, like ibuprofen, every single day.
Okay, we touched on this earlier, but break down the exact mechanism. Why does taking ibuprofen for knee pain ruin the heart failure treatment?
Because everything is connected. To filter blood, the kidneys rely on specific chemicals called prostaglandins, which keep the blood vessels leading into the kidney dilated and open.
Okay.
NSAIDs like ibuprofen work by blocking the production of prostaglandins.
That's how they stop the inflammation and pain in the knee.
Yes. But by blocking those prostaglandins systemically, the blood vessels leading into the kidney clamp tightly shut. The blood flow to the kidney drops. When the kidney senses a drop in blood flow, it panics, assumes the body is bleeding to death, and starts desperately hoarding sodium and water to keep blood pressure up.
So the cardiologist diuretic is screaming at the kidney to release the water, while the ibuprofen is screaming at the kidney to hoard the water.
And the ibuprofen wins. The fluid backs up into the lungs. Furthermore, the clinician asks, "Do you have a bathroom scale at home?" The patient says no. So they have absolutely no way to monitor their daily weight to see if they're retaining 3 pounds of water overnight.
So the environment is actively sabotaging the heart.
If you don't uncover those coupling conditions, the NSAIDs and the lack of a scale, you will never stop the cycle of readmissions.
I listen to this, and logically it makes absolute sense. But I'm going to push back hard on the reality of implementing this.
Yeah.
I have friends who are doctors. I know the brutal reality of a hospital ward.
It's tough.
A junior doctor might have a roster of 30 sick patients to round on before lunchtime. They have maybe 6 minutes per room. Is it genuinely fair or even possible to expect an exhausted doctor to sit down and investigate whether an elderly patient has a staircase in their house, or whether they can afford their electricity bill to keep the fridge running, or what over-the-counter pain meds they bought at the pharmacy?
It is the most vital pushback to this entire framework. Time is the most scarce resource in modern medicine. But Dr. Sahali's answer to this is stark and uncompromising. He argues that yes, it is required. Because a technically correct medical plan that the patient cannot physically or financially execute is not just a waste of time, it is an actively unsafe plan.
It's basically medical theater.
It is. If you spend 5 minutes writing a brilliant prescription that the patient cannot afford, you haven't treated them. You've just done paperwork. The manuscript argues that labeling a patient as non-compliant is almost always a failure of the clinician's curiosity. It stops the inquiry precisely when it needs to begin. The true clinician must always ask, what specific environmental condition is making the healthy action impossible for this person?
Okay, so the clinician has done the deep work. They understand the failing capacities. They've mapped out the coupling conditions of the patient's life. Now, finally, it is time to intervene. It is time to treat the patient. But the manuscript doesn't use the word treatment. It uses a very specific, slightly intimidating phrase. Wise perturbation.
It is a phenomenal choice of words. Treatment implies a one-way street. I give you the pill fixes the problem, end of story. Perturbation is a systems biology term. It means introducing a disruption into an already complex dynamic ecosystem.
It acknowledges that you can't just change one thing. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Every single medical intervention alters physiology and alters risk. You might solve the immediate problem, but you are simultaneously sending shockwaves through the rest of the body. You are perturbing the system.
I was trying to conceptualize this, and the best analogy I could think of is the classic ecological disaster of pest control. It's like a farmer realizing beetles are eating his crops. So he introduces a new species of toad into the environment to eat the beetles.
The cane toad in Australia is the classic example.
Exactly. The intervention of the toad is highly effective at eating the beetles. The immediate crop problem is solved. But suddenly, the toads have no natural predators. They multiply out of control. They start eating the native birds. They poison the local pets. And now you have a catastrophic ecological crisis that is infinitely worse than the beetles.
Medical interventions operate on the exact same principle. The text provides a series of stark examples of these biological trade-offs, the double-edged swords of medicine. Let's look at IV fluids.
Seems harmless enough. Just salt water.
Pumping 4 fluids into a patient who is severely dehydrated, perhaps someone with an acute kidney injury from profound vomiting, is life-saving. It restores the blood pressure and flushes the kidneys.
Right.
But, as we discussed with the heart failure patient, if you push those same fluids into a patient whose heart pump is too weak to circulate them, the fluids have nowhere to go but into the lungs. You literally drown the patient from the inside out to save their kidneys.
What about sedatives? This is a huge issue in hospitals, right? Dealing with agitated patients.
Imagine the elderly man with delirium we discussed earlier. He is hallucinating, he is terrified, and he is actively trying to pull out his IV line, which is delivering life-saving antibiotics. The immediate localized problem is he is pulling out the line.
So the immediate localized fix is to give him a heavy sedative, a chemical restraint.
It stops the immediate action. The IV line is safe. But what is the systemic perturbation? Sedatives actively worsen the underlying neurological architecture of delirium. They prolong the confusion. Furthermore, by heavily sedating an elderly patient, you drastically suppress their gag reflex. Now, when they swallow their own saliva, instead of going down to the stomach, it slides past the relaxed vocal cords and into the lungs.
Aspiration pneumonia.
Yes. You introduced a toad to save the high V line, and the patient dies of a hospital-acquired pneumonia. You also destroyed their mobility, virtually guaranteeing they will lose muscle mass and likely suffer a catastrophic fall when they eventually try to stand.
Pain relief has to be the most famous double-edged sword of all. Opioids.
Opioids are nothing short of miraculous for severe acute pain. They bind to the mu opioid receptors in the brain and block the perception of suffering. But those same mu receptors exist in high densities in the gastrointestinal tract. When the opioids bind there, they completely freeze the peristalsis, the muscular contractions of the gut,
causing severe constipation,
which can quickly escalate into a full bowel obstruction, which is a surgical emergency. Additionally, opioids bind to the brainstem centers that control the autonomic respiratory drive. The brain simply forgets to tell the lungs to breathe. The pain is gone, but the patient stops breathing.
Because of these massive ripple effects, the text outlines a very strict checklist for what elevates an intervention from just a perturbation to a wise perturbation.
An intervention must meet specific criteria. It must be strictly indicated. There must be a clear, biologically sound reason for doing it. It must be proportionate to the actual danger.
You don't use a sledgehammer to kill a fly.
Exactly. It must be feasible within the patient's coupling conditions, as we discussed. It must be monitorable. You have to have a way of measuring if the toad is eating the beetles or the birds. It must be adjustable. Can you lower the dose if things go wrong? And it must be deeply context aware.
There is another aspect of the section that I found incredibly counterintuitive. We are so conditioned to think of medical treatment as doing something, prescribing a drug, cutting something out. But the manuscript argues that sometimes the wisest perturbation is doing absolutely nothing, right, or actually reversing a previous action.
The concept of de-escalation, knowing when to stop a medication, reduce a dose, or taper a treatment, is an incredibly advanced clinical skill. Yesterday's life-saving treatment is often today's toxin.
Give me an example of that.
Let's look at antibiotics. A patient comes in with a severe blood infection, sepsis. You blast them with broad-spectrum, highly potent IV antibiotics. It is the correct, wise perturbation. It saves their life.
Right.
5 days later, the infection is cleared. But if you just leave them on those broad-spectrum antibiotics out of momentum or fear, you are now carpet bombing their healthy gut microbiome.
You're wiping out all the good bacteria.
And when the good bacteria are gone, dangerous opportunistic bacteria like C. diff can colonize the gut, causing life-threatening diarrhea and colon inflammation. The wise perturbation on day 5 is active de-escalation, stopping the drug.
And what about doing nothing at all?
Watchful waiting. If the initial danger screen shows the patient is stable and the syndrome is unclear but not high risk, the wisest move is often to hold your fire. Let the illness declare itself. But, and this is a massive caveat, watchful waiting is only safe if it is paired with rigorous safety netting.
Meaning giving the patient very clear instructions on when to panic.
Yes. I don't think this is dangerous right now, but if your fever spikes above 102 or if you feel breathless when you walk to the kitchen, you must return immediately. Watchful waiting without safety netting is just negligence.
So the clinician introduces the wise perturbation. They start the drug, or they stop the drug, or they actively wait. But the ecosystem is now reacting. The ripples are spreading. And this brings us to the final critical step of the entire life coherent loop. Step 6, tracking the repair trajectory.
This is where the clinician must confront what Dr. Sahili calls the fallacy of better numbers.
It's human nature, right? We love metrics. If my blood pressure was high yesterday and it's lower today, I am getting better. If my white blood cell count was off the charts and now it's back in the normal range, I am healing. The numbers don't lie.
The numbers don't lie about the specific microscopic variable they are measuring, but they can absolutely lie about the human being. Repair is not synonymous with normalization of data. A patient can have a chart full of steadily improving numbers while their actual life capacity is catastrophically worsening.
Walk me through a scenario where the numbers look great, but the patient is failing.
Let's return to our elderly patient with severe pneumonia. After 4 days of IV antibiotics, the doctor looks at the morning labs. The white blood cell count has plummeted back to a perfect normal. The thermometer shows the fever has completely broken. The oxygen saturation on the monitor reads 99%.
So the biological data says the infection has been defeated.
But look at the patient in the bed. He hasn't eaten solid food in 4 days. He is so profoundly delirious from the hospital environment and the sleep deprivation that he doesn't know his own daughter's name.
Wow.
His leg muscles have atrophied so rapidly from bed rest that he cannot even sit up on the edge of the mattress without two nurses holding him. The numbers are pristine. The patient is broken.
He is biologically cured but functionally destroyed.
Exactly. If the doctor only tracks the numbers, they declare victory and walk away. The life coherent framework demands that we track real-world markers of repair. Healing means the human being, not just their blood plasma, is returning to a state of coherence.
So what are the actual metrics of true repair? How do you measure it?
The manuscript outlines 4 pillars of repair. The patient must be becoming safer, clearer, stronger, and more supported. Real repair looks like a patient who can breathe easily without the nasal cannula. It looks like a patient who can safely transfer from the bed to the chair without feeling dizzy. It looks like a patient whose mind is clear enough to accurately repeat their new medication schedule back to the nurse.
And what about the environment?
That's the supported pillar. Repair means the family members are engaged, they understand the trajectory, and they aren't completely burned out. It means the patient's dignity has been protected throughout the indignity of hospitalization. If those functional capacities are not returning, the repair trajectory is failing, regardless of what the blood tests say.
I want to highlight something really fascinating buried in the appendix of this manuscript, because it ties directly into this idea of tracking repair. The author does a deep dive into the language doctors use to communicate with each other, because how the medical team talks actually dictates the safety of the trajectory.
Yes, the text takes direct aim at the culture of medical abbreviations and rushed communication. It argues that poor communication actively sabotages the repair trajectory by obscuring danger.
The examples are almost comical until you realize the stakes. Medical charts are basically written in a different language.
They are heavily encrypted with acronyms designed to save the doctor 3 seconds of typing, but they introduce massive risk. The text points out the danger of writing SOB in a chart.
To a clinician, SOB just means shortness of breath. It's standard.
But medical records are now openly accessible to patients and their families through online portals. Imagine a daughter reading her elderly mother's chart and seeing a doctor describe her as a difficult patient, severe SOB. Out of context, that is deeply confusing, highly offensive, and instantly destroys the trust between the family and the medical team.
Which destroys the supported pillar of the repair trajectory. Another abbreviation that blew my mind was OD.
In a prescription context, particularly in the UK and other systems, OD is derived from Latin and means once daily. Take this pill OD, but in the emergency room context, OD means overdose.
If a nurse misreads a hastily scribbled note, the consequences are lethal.
Which is why the author insists that abbreviation should never ever be used when describing risk or danger. And this extends to how doctors hand over patients at the end of a shift.
The handover. The moment where one doctor goes home to sleep and a fresh doctor takes over the ward.
It is the most dangerous moment in a hospital. The continuity of the patient's ecosystem is broken and must be rebuilt in the mind of the new doctor. The text contrasts a weak, dangerous handover with a safe, coherent one.
A weak handover is just the raw data, right?
It's just a weak handover sounds like this. Patient in bed 4 has AKI, K is high, just repeat the labs later.
AKI meaning acute kidney injury and K meaning potassium.
Correct. The departing doctor feels they have communicated the facts, but they haven't communicated the trajectory or the danger. The receiving doctor is left to guess what high means and what to do about it. Contrast that with the safer handover the text mandates.
How should it sound?
The patient in bed 4 has an acute kidney injury and their potassium is dangerously high at 6.2. I have ordered a repeat blood draw for 2 a.m. If the potassium remains above 6.0, or if you see any changes on their ECG monitor indicating their heart rhythm is becoming unstable, you must escalate this to the attending physician immediately for dialysis.
The difference is night and day. The first one is a data dump. The second one is a conditional survival plan. It anticipates the failure and provides the exact mechanism for action.
Clear communication is the scaffolding that allows repair to happen. If the scaffolding is weak, the trajectory collapses.
I have one final question about this entire concept of repair. The loop implies a return to functioning, a return to the baseline. But what happens when the biology is permanently broken? Does this entire framework just fall apart when a patient has a progressive terminal illness? What does repair mean for someone with ALS or stage 4 pancreatic cancer?
It's a beautiful and necessary question. The manuscript is profoundly clear on this. Repair does not always mean cure. The loop does not fail. It adapts to the reality of the ecosystem.
How do you repair someone who is dying?
You shift the goal of the perturbation. In a slowly progressive disease, like chronic kidney failure, repair means fiercely protecting the remaining capacity. It means slowing the rate of decline so the patient gets 2 more years of walking their dog instead of 6 months.
You change the slope of the fall.
Yes. And at the absolute end of life, when biological cure is impossible, repair takes on its most sacred meaning. Repair means aggressive symptom relief. It means absolute dedication to the patient's comfort. It means actively protecting their dignity when their body is failing them. It means having the hard conversations to align their medical care with their personal values, ensuring they spend their final days in the environment they choose, surrounded by the coupling conditions they love.
Repair is about keeping the care relentlessly responsive to what the human being actually needs in that specific fleeting moment of their life.
Exactly. It refuses to abandon the patient just because the disease cannot be defeated.
Okay. Let's take a breath and zoom all the way out.
Yeah.
Because this has been a massive fundamental shift in how we are asked to view the human body and the medical system. We have walked step by step through Dr. Saif Healy's life coherent clinical loop.
We started by rejecting the illusion of the textbook and the danger of treating a label.
We anchored ourselves in danger-first thinking, checking the collapsing roof, checking the glucose, and fighting the psychological urge to say, it's just anxiety, or it's just dementia.
We learned how to organize chaotic symptoms into actionable syndromes to guide our testing, rather than blindly trusting the machines.
We moved past the biological diagnosis to map out capacity failure, understanding exactly what life functions. From sleep to dignity, were being destroyed.
We examined the coupling conditions, recognizing that the stairs in a patient's home or the NSAIDs in their medicine cabinet dictate their survival just as much as their genetics.
We weighed the double-edged swords of wise perturbation, treating every drug and every surgery as a shockwave introduced into a delicate ecosystem.
And finally, we committed to tracking the true repair trajectory, looking past the pristine numbers on a chart to ensure the human being is actually becoming safer, stronger, and more supported.
It is an incredibly rigorous, deeply humane way of approaching the chaos of illness. It categorically refuses to reduce you to a broken machine on an assembly line. And for you listening to this, here is the immediate real-world application. The next time you're sitting in a sterile clinic room or standing next to a hospital bed advocating for someone you love, you can use this exact architecture.
You no longer have to be a passive recipient of medical data.
When the doctor rushes in and says, the diagnosis is X, we are prescribing Y, don't just nod and accept the label. Push deeper. Ask them the life-coherent questions. Doctor, what specific daily function is this illness threatening? What are the ripple effects, the collateral harm that this new medication might cause to their other organs? What specific environmental hurdles at our house do we need to worry about? And what does actual functional improvement look like tomorrow so we know this plan is actually working?
By asking those questions, you force the system to see the ecosystem. You become a vital active partner in the clinical loop.
But if we take this framework and we step outside the hospital doors, this leads to a really profound implication. And I want to leave you with this final provocative thought to chew on. What if we applied this exact life coherent loop to the non-medical crises in our lives?
The patterns of systemic failure are remarkably similar everywhere.
Think about when a society tries to fix a failing public school, or when an EEO tries to turn around a hemorrhaging business, or even when we individually try to break a toxic personal habit. Our absolute default instinct is the medical textbook illusion. We slap a localized label on the problem, lazy teachers, bad middle management, lack of personal willpower, and we prescribe a forceful, isolated treatment, fire the staff, cut the budget, try harder.
We treat the symptom, we ignore the ecosystem, and we are shocked when the patient bounces right back into the ER.
But what if we paused? What if we secured the immediate danger first? What if we asked, What specific capacity is actually failing in this school or this relationship? What hidden environmental coupling conditions, poverty, burnout, structural incentives, are actively keeping this problem alive despite our best efforts? And how do we introduce a wise perturbation, a change that actually heals the system without causing devastating collateral damage to the people living inside it?
It demands that we stop looking for broken parts to swap out and start doing the hard work of understanding the ecosystem.
Because whether you are trying to heal a failing heart or a failing community, treating the label will always leave you dangerously incomplete. You have to treat the living, breathing whole.